From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Everyone seems to want money from investors. I mean, I guess not everyone. There are plenty of bootstrappers out there. But anecdotally speaking, at least, founders are very often asking me about how to approach or impress investors. It's all kind of founders, all kinds of companies, all coming to the same conclusion. To grow their business, they need to trade some equity for a bundle of investor cash. Why is this? Honestly, I kind of wonder how shows like Shark Tank and our very own Entrepreneur Elevator Pitch are contributing to it, giving the impression that every founder must follow this path to investment. But the thing is, not everyone needs it. Not everyone should take it. And also, not everyone's going to get it. And if you do seek out investment and everyone tells you no, you need to know that is not the end of your company. And that right there is what this episode is about. How to build a company when every investor says no. Because more often than not, that is what's going to happen. A small percentage of founders get funded. So what to do next if you're basically everybody else? I want you to meet these two guys who had to figure that answer out for themselves. And it took a few minutes to get our interview going because they work at a pretty noisy office these days and they had to keep trying to get everyone to quiet down.
All right. We're just running around telling people to shut up. All right. So yeah. Hi, man. I'm Sasha Cohn.
I'm Eric Allen Ford.
Sasha and Eric are the co-founders of a men's clothing company called Buck Mason. In 2014, they scored a huge hit with a t-shirt that the Wall Street Journal called one of the best around, and soon after, they decided to go big. They wanted to take in millions of dollars and drive this company to rapid growth. So they tapped their network, got some introductions to investors, and then made the tour.
When we walked into the offices, everybody really wanted to talk about growth. And while we felt good about our growth, you know, we could tout 300%, 400% increases. The numbers were still relatively small to, I think, what most of them were looking at. And really, everybody told us no.
The numbers he's talking about, by the way, are sales numbers. I mean, growth percentages were great, but they're, you know, for a young company, they're always going to sound great. Sell $100 worth of shirts in a year and $200 the next year, and you've got yourself a 100% growth rate. Woohoo! It's meaningless. What matters is actual sales and revenue. And while they had something to show for themselves, it wasn't enough for investors to say, oh yeah, this is a company that's going to 10x my investment. And this forced the guys of Buck Mason to start thinking very differently about their business.
And we started to think about, let's be strong, let's not be big.
Strong, not big. That became Eric and Sasha's philosophy. It became their guiding principle, and it's led them to great things. Buck Mason has been profitable for 3 years. It has 50 employees. It sold a million t-shirts, and it has 5 physical stores, 3 in LA and 2 in New York. So what does it mean to be strong, not big? And how can that become the North Star for companies that can't win over investors? We'll get into it all right after the break. FedEx delivers millions of packages around the world. But for FedEx, it's not just about packages or pallets. It's about what those deliveries mean for people. Whether it's rekindling a long-lost connection between old friends, a new business opportunity, or providing much-needed hope after a natural disaster in the form of relief supplies, FedEx delivers more than just packages. FedEx delivers possibilities. Find out more at fedex.com/possibilities.
And now our second sponsor.
Here's something I just learned. Air filter technology is super old. The HEPA filter was developed in the 1940s. And so when a scientist's son recently had allergies and existing air filters weren't helping, he did what entrepreneurs do and dove in to solve the problem himself. The result is Molecule, a breakthrough filter that doesn't just capture air pollutants, but destroys them at a molecular level.
The company has been funded by the EPA and tested by third-party laboratories, but science aside, the company is especially proud of the impact it has on real people. It has data showing that it can make a meaningful impact in reducing symptoms for asthma and allergy sufferers after just 1 week of use. One customer even told Molecule that she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. Want to try it yourself? Molecule is offering a special deal to listeners of this show. For $75 off your first order, visit Molecule, that is MOLEKULE.com, and enter the promo code Problem Solvers. All right, we're back. So first, where did Buck Mason come from? Back in 2011 or 2012, the guys can't really remember, they met as neighbors in Venice Beach. Eric at the time was overseeing a few apparel brands at a large company, and Sasha had gone through a series of tech startups, but was really looking for a new opportunity. The guys got to talking about how to combine their backgrounds in apparel and tech, because Eric had this idea for a men's clothing brand that was really focused on basic classics. Solid color t-shirts, shirts, pants, and so on. Really simple, timeless men's stuff.
We both threw $5,000 in a bank account, and we were kind of off to the races.
They decided to start with a simple t-shirt. Eric designed the collection while Sasha built their website. They got a 350-square-foot garage in Venice Beach that they turned into both their office and a little storefront, which cost exactly $933 to build out. And with this, they began selling a few hundred t-shirts a month, which they saw as a nice start while they were figuring out how to really operate their business. They also started doing a little PR just by themselves, you know, shooting off cold emails and mailing t-shirts to editors. One shirt went to somebody at the Wall Street Journal who didn't write about it, but just happened to have it lying around on her desk when another writer found it while writing a story about t-shirts. That writer tried the shirt on, loved it, and featured it huge in the paper with glowing praise under the headline, "The Benefits of a Better Men's T-Shirt."
We'd been doing about $3,000 or $4,000 a month up until that point. And we did $100,000 in 48 hours. And that was kind of the moment that we realized we had a business. So most of that first year was kind of, you know, just connected to that Wall Street Journal business.
So this is the moment when Eric and Sasha's ambitions really start to grow. They're getting all these sales and figure this is the time to go raise money from investors and then really slam the gas. Take this little t-shirt brand and amplify it to the next Uniqlo or whatever. Now, for anyone in a similar situation, which is to say that you get a great piece of press and it juiced sales, here's a little word of advice from me. Don't get comfortable. Don't think that just because you got one piece of press that you'll get another, and don't think that that bump you enjoyed because of one story is going to continue. Press can provide a nice boost, but it's unpredictable and uncontrollable, and you shouldn't make any long-term decisions based on it. I've met founders who literally quit their full-time job the day they got some big publication who like wrote about their side hustle, and I always wanted to be like, oh, maybe that's not a great plan. And here with Eric and Sasha, they were about to find out that a big boost in sales from a Wall Street Journal piece was not enough to make investors really sit up and take notice. Like you heard at the top of the show, they got no's from every investor they met. No, 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 nice t-shirt, but no. And this left them feeling dejected. Could they really build the company of their dreams without this money, they wondered? And then Eric stumbled upon something that changed his way of thinking.
I went on a trip and took a little bit of time off. And one of the books I took with me was Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. And I didn't actually know this previously, but he was a merchant entrepreneur at a very young age. And in this autobiography, he included his general ledger. And of course, there was all sorts of amazing wisdom in this book, but his general ledger really kind of blew my mind. His goal was entirely to take in more money than he spent. And it was as easy as balancing a checkbook. And I think I brought that back to Sasha and said, dude, we don't have to raise $10 million to have a successful clothing brand. Like, what if we raised just a little bit of money? And what if we focused on self-reliance and staying inside of our means? And, you know, I think that was when the strength versus growth concept really came to life.
It sounds simple, doesn't it? make more than you spend? But companies often lose sight of this when they start thinking really, really big. They start to think, well, we can't become a big company unless we have this gigantic rocket booster attached to us. But no, not true. What Eric was saying was just, let's focus on fundamentals. We'll build a business step by step on the strength of our own product and customer relationships and brand and ultimately the profit we make. So, now they took a step back and thought, what were we doing to become a big company, and how can we instead become a strong company? The first change they made was to their focus.
It started with product. You know, people who are thinking about things other than making the best product never make the best product. So we became a product company. We switched from having a focus that was more on distribution and technology to making the very best product we could. We invested more resources in our design team. We transitioned to more serious suppliers. We figured out margin. We developed a kind of a seven, we really developed a list of seven principles or what we call measures of strength. And those were number one, product quality. Number two, profitability. Three, customer loyalty. Four, margin. Five, brand equity. Six, revenue growth. And seven, operational rigor. And when we looked at those seven things, we said, okay, how can we move the needle and just be a little bit better tomorrow than we were yesterday in those areas?
And maybe you're thinking, as I did, but wait a second, you were already a product company. I mean, you're a company that sells a product, and that product is clothing. So how does a product company become more of a product company? So I asked Eric to dive into that a little more.
We were probably thinking about things like the direct-to-consumer model, and we were pretty obsessed with the direct-to-consumer disruption period and watching all of our contemporaries at the time. The reality is that had nothing to do with why customers wanted our product. They wanted our product because they felt like it was a great quality for a great value.
In other words, they were focused on all of these ideas and tactics about sales that were ultimately not related at all to the reason their customers liked the stuff. And a company can absolutely become distracted by those. I hear it all the time. You know, just the day before recording this episode, in fact, a woman was telling me about her company that does a form of home healthcare, but she kept referring to it as a tech company or a platform because that's the system she built to operate it. So that's the way she thinks. But I told her, you know, for consumers and media to understand you, you need to stop referring to it as a platform. That's not what they care about. They care about home health care. And now you can see Buck Mason making this very same realization about their own business. In addition, they started to expand their product offerings. They began with t-shirts, but now they're adding polos, jeans, and so on. And they come up with a very specific vision, which they don't deviate from. It is a simple color palette, no crazy patterns, no trying to be everything to everyone, just basic, very masculine. Now, the next thing that Buck Mason guys want to do is improve their relationships with their customers. You know, if you're a big clothing company, maybe all you want to do is sell a ton of t-shirts to everyone you can reach. That's what going big is. But if you're a strong clothing company, you want to make sure that you're developing a great relationship with every consumer and that you're building a brand and a story that they identify with. And Eric and Sasha realized that at the beginning, they weren't doing a great job of reaching out to customers. They were just waiting for people to stumble upon them or to find them through like that Wall Street Journal piece. So that's what led them to open a retail location. I mean, you might remember they were already running this tiny little store-like thing out of the garage that was also their office in Venice Beach. But now we're talking about a real store, full build out on Abbot Kinney, a super hot street in LA. And with this, they'd be able to really see their customer and learn from them and also just earn that customer's loyalty.
People really love to shop physically. They love to touch. Men are very tactile. Men love to come in the store and touch product and try product on. I think naturally, we're skeptical of, you know, online brands. And once you kind of see it in a real store and you see that there's a little bit of operational rigor behind a company or a brand, I think you start to develop a little bit more trust.
Now, you might say, wait a second, doesn't a physical store cost a lot of money to open? And yes, it can. And they actually had some to spend. Despite getting rejected from venture capitalists, Buck Mason did find a few angel investors willing to put in a total of $1.5 million into the company. So they had some financial flexibility here. And to be clear, I mean, you can still build what they're building, though just on a slower timetable without that money, right? You don't need it. You don't need it. That's the point. But if you can get it, take it. So they found ways to do the whole thing on the cheap anyway, because they weren't going to blow all that cash on a shop. While they were building the shop, for example, they flew their dads out from Missouri and Cleveland to help them with the manual labor. They basically built the thing out themselves. And this theme would carry throughout what they do next.
You know, actually, the reality was what happened that year, now that I think about it, there's only one giant change. We just stopped spending money. We didn't keep hiring that next person. We didn't hire that next person. We didn't spend that next dollar. And sales continued to climb. We spent less. We spent the same amount of money, but sales began to climb and we became profitable. It was actually quite simple. I mean, we had great momentum. The brand had already had traction. There was growth happening. We were moving forward. We just stopped overspending and sales sort of took care of the rest, and we were all of a sudden a profitable company.
Today, Buck Mason does feel like a really strong company, the guys say. They make money, they're growing, they're opening new retail locations, and they have genuine fans who keep coming back. Is Buck Mason a giant unicorn of a startup with 800 locations and a sponsorship deal with Tom Brady? No. But that's the definition of a big company, a company that's probably spending more than it's making and whose investors are demanding to see growth all the time. Buck Mason chose the other path, the path of going slow and strong. This should be an optimistic story for anyone who's been turned down by investors. It's not because investors are saying you don't have a good business. It's just not a business for them. And that's okay. You don't need to make a business that pleases investors. You just need to step back and ask, how can I make a business that pleases me and my customers? That's the definition of a strong business. It's the kind you can be personally invested in. And that's our episode. But wait, before you go, please hear me out on a few ways you can stay in touch with the show and contact me directly. First of all, if you like the show, it would be amazing if you subscribe to it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Problem Solvers. That way, you'll never miss an episode. We come out every Monday morning. Also, I love hearing from listeners. You can go to jasonpfeiffer.com. That's J-A-S-O-N, F as in Frank, E-I, F as in Frank, E-R.com, where you'll find my email address, social media handles, and also you can sign up for my monthly newsletter, The Pfeiffer 5, which is 5 monthly insights and bursts of inspiration for entrepreneurs. It's basically a collection of the ideas that excited me the most that month. So please go check it out. And that's again, jasonpfeiffer.com. And if you want to drop me a line directly, please let me know about the problems you've solved, and I might have you read the letter in a future episode of the show. We can all learn from each other, and that also means you. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media, and this episode was edited by Conrad Martin. We are also online at entrepreneur.com. Again, I'm Jason Pfeiffer. Thanks for listening, and now go solve some problems.